Hi, and welcome back to JaffeWoodwinds.com. Today we have a guest who is really a triple threat, someone who initially made his mark in the industry as a conductor, but also as a well-regarded orchestrator and composer, who for many years now has lived out in LA, but also began his career in New York, where he was born. Larry Blank has had an amazing career, a very diverse career, and I'll just give some of the credits that Larry has accomplished. There will be a link to his website in the text accompanying this video, and I hope all of you will endeavor to check that out because the full scope of his musical career will be in front of you, and it's quite amazing. But as a conductor, musical director of Broadway shows, both in New York and in LA, Larry has conducted just a handful that I'm going to indicate: Good Time Charlie, They're Playing Our Song, Evita, Sugar Babies, La Cage, Chorus Line, Phantom, Sweeney Todd, Teddy and Alice, Copperfield. As an orchestrator, he's also been very involved with Broadway over the years, and orchestrating for Drowsy Chaperone, Whole Christmas, Catch Me If You Can, A Christmas Story, Honeymoon in Vegas, Holiday Inn, The Producers. He's orchestrated ballets, Zorro, films, Chicago, the film Chicago, Mrs. Santa Claus, Christmas on the Square. For TV, he's done work with South Park, and over the years on the Grammy Awards and the Academy Awards. He's also the conductor now of the Pasadena Symphony, and he's conducted regularly in London for the Olivier Awards. He's done pops concerts throughout the world and conducted just about every major American orchestra: the New York Philharmonic, San Francisco Symphony, Chicago Symphony, the LA Phil, Boston Pops. So it's a real honor to have Larry Blank with us today. And Larry, thank you for offering your time and giving us this opportunity to delve into your career. And I know the amount of knowledge and experience you've had will be quite helpful, especially to younger people looking for guidance in this industry. So again, thank you. And let's go into, where you grew up. I know you're a Brooklyn guy, and what instrument you began on, and how you sort of moved into the music industry.
Thank you, and I'm really happy to be here talking to you and catching up on all of this stuff, and talking to a New Yorker is always a pleasure. So
Exactly.
it's funny, when I started, I grew up in Brooklyn, and like a lot of families, my parents had music on the piano, usually Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff, because my mother played the piano very well. And my father would, who was a chemist, would play the mandolin, and so there was always music around the house. And of course, in New York, the custom was always to take the kids to a Broadway show once they got old enough, when they were reasonably priced, because in
Right.
those
And
days,
a family of four could go.
orchestra seats for a matinee were $6. It was a lot of money, but compared to now, it was nothing.
Yes.
And my mother wanted me to play the piano, and I had no interest whatsoever. And my brother, who was a little bit older, played the five-string banjo. He's now an insurance salesman, by the way. But he played the five-string banjo, and I took up the guitar. So I learned to read music on the guitar and playing guitar simple stuff, all those Mel Bay books. But I also noodled at the piano. And after a few years, I got more interested in the piano, and I liked show music, so I would have sheet music on the piano and start playing show tunes. So that's how I got to the piano.
Okay.
And truthfully, I wanted to be an actor just because. And I'm jumping ahead, but I went to the High School of Performing Arts as a drama student.
Huh.
But all the while, I was studying piano, not to be a great technician, just to be facile enough to play show tunes. And I would go to the library and get all these show scores and open them up and try to play them. And most of the time, I was playing the accompaniments without the melody, because that's what the show scores were. And My brother and sister would be screaming, said, "Can't you play any songs?" Because all I was playing was thumb lines and afterbeats.
Right.
And that was my musical training.
But you were at
Just
the Performing Arts High School when it was on 46th Street,
absolutely.
and getting a full background in, I imagine, classical, Western European classical music there at the time, and being right in the heart of the music district on West 46th Street there. You weren't just exposed to show music. I mean, you were in the midst of everything that New York had to offer at that time, I would imagine.
Well, the thing is, I used to go to Broadway shows, and of course, the orchestra pits were 26 pieces, and you could actually see the musicians. And I remember always getting first row seats so I could actually look in the pit because my interest was always more in music. And even though I was in the drama department, many of my buddies were in the youth orchestras around New York from the music department, and they would invite me to rehearsals. So I remember watching William Steinberg rehearsing my buddies playing a lot of classical music. So I was exposed to a lot of that. I just got invited. I remember Steinberg was the music director in Buffalo, so they called him Buffalo Bill.
Right. And he also, I think, was in Pittsburgh either before or after
Yes.
that. And just a little aside, one of the great recordings of the Beethoven symphonies, the entire nine symphonies, Steinberg and the Pittsburgh Orchestra, if one can still get a hold of it, it's not often talked about, but my God, it was a tremendous orchestra at the time, and his interpretations were phenomenal.
Absolutely. And I was sitting there, and he was one of those old martinets who would scream at the kids a little bit, as was the style. But I really was shocked how interested I was in it. And what finally happened was I saw the show Mame. This was about 1966, so I would have been 14 years old. And the conductor was Don Pippin. And it was at the Winter Garden. In those days, the pits were very exposed and the musicians could be seen. They couldn't get away without, you had to wear a jacket and a tie in the pit in those days. And I was so impressed by it, I introduced myself to Pippin after the show. And I was 13, 14 years old, and we became friends. And he said, "Keep in touch." And I did as my career progressed. And I think meeting Don was something that made me switch to music. And midway at the High School Performing Arts, I switched to music. They would not let me switch departments. So I had to leave in the last year and finish at Bayside High School. But here's the kicker. I joke about this. I was the least expensive pianist in all of New York because I learned to play rehearsal piano, and I was getting called to play off Broadway where everybody was working cheap because I was a very facile reader because of all my time spent in front of the piano. And here's a little story I very rarely tell, but one day I got a call from another pianist in town named Barry, who was doing an off-Broadway show called The Drunkard. And he said that he had a nightclub act for the Catskills, Adam and Ira. Adam was a big, chubby Italian singer, and Ira was a Jewish comedian. So it was very much like Martin Rossi, Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis type of thing. It was very common in those days. There were a lot of acts like that. And they were doing the Catskills, and he had to bow out of this gig. And I was only 16, remember, because he had another job with a chick singer named Bette, who was going to be playing the Continental Bath. So the pianist who called me was Barry Manilow.
Barry Manilow, wow.
And he was just another piano player around New York playing shows. And coincidentally, I never crossed paths with Barry over the years. And then one day I got called to orchestrate for him for a record. And I walked in to a meeting with him, and he looked at me and he says, "Why didn't you tell me you were that kid from years ago. So we were
Right,
talking on the phone. He didn't put together the name and the person.
right.
So it's just a funny coincidence. But that's where I would have to say the Don Pippin kind of took over, my career when I was very young and was promoting me from an early time.
And Don Pippin was a very, very, very active musical director on Broadway, and also with films. And all, I know he for years conducted the Miss America pageant as well, down in Atlantic City. And he was a big force in the industry in the 60s, 70s. And I think he was the original conductor of A Chorus Line too, if I'm not
He
mistaken.
was and promoted me to later on to conduct the tour. And also, you say Miss America, and I was the orchestrator along with Harold Wheeler. And I got to tell you, I was late to coming to orchestration, but Don made sure I got hired. And I said, "Don, why are you promoting me so hard as an orchestrator?" He said, "To get you out of town, you're too much competition for me on the podium."
Yeah, well, he was a very intelligent fellow. Not the greatest stick technique, but he knew what how to, he knew the pacing of a show, and if there was ever a problem, that was just my yeah, I was a very young player when I encountered him, but whenever there might be a problem or there was something that was slightly running afoul, boy, he was Johnny to the spot and get you right back. I mean, he never missed in that way. You thought he was just sort of like daydreaming, just going through the motions, and something would go off and bang, he was there. Which is
Showbiz.
really, which is what the role of a conductor when you're conducting 8 shows a week and the musicians know the music inside and out, everybody's going through the motions and something goes off. That's when you need the conductor.
Show business. That's
Yes.
what he was great at. And he really taught that to me. And admittedly, technically that wasn't his thing, although he was a brilliant classical pianist.
Huh, I
He
did not
had,
know that.
and even on a few show albums, I think Shenandoah and Irma La Douce, he was the keyboard in the pit,
I had no idea.
which were difficult shows. He had a lot of chops, but it translated into his being a very strong music director.
Sure. Wow. So here you are, you're a young guy, you're just getting your feet wet as a piano accompanist, and you jumped ahead to when Don sort of got you into conducting, but you were one of the very youngest people to take over a show when you conducted Where's Charlie? You were only about 22 or so.
Good Time Charlie. Yeah, I
Good
was
Time Charlie.
22, and what happened was, I'll tell you how I got it. I was assisting Arthur B. Rubinstein, who was a very good composer orchestrator. He was originally a French horn player. He was conducting Broadway shows and a lot of television and ultimately film music. He did War Games and a few others. And I had assisted Arthur on, I was a keyboard player on a show in Buffalo, New York, and he was the orchestrator. So he took a liking to me, and then he did a production of the Mark Blitzstein show Juno at Williamstown. And he got a fantastic band out of New York to do this, and I was the keyboard player. And then he was doing the show Good Time Charlie, and it was a huge musical with Joel Grey, but Jonathan Tunick orchestrated it, and it was a flop. It was running 2 or 3 months, and Arthur had to leave the show to do something else just for the last week or two. And he said to me haphazardly, there was no a particular assistant conductor on the show. There was no keyboard in the pit. He assigned somebody, but I don't even remember who it was, and said to me, "Would you like to take over the show?" And he announced that I was the new conductor of the show. Now, I have to say, I'd already been conducting in summer stock. I was on the road with a little night music, so I wasn't inexperienced by any means,
But you were
but
still 22.
I was 22 years old, and he announced that I was conducting the show. I was introduced to Joel Grey, who bit his lip and, looking at 22-year-old kid, and I took over the show. And because I was young and ambitious, I had it totally memorized. I got up on the podium with a bunch of all of the old guys on Broadway. It was a Jonathan Tunick selected orchestra, and I made sure that I imitated every move that Arthur made on the podium. And my first performance went perfectly, just because I was so diligent. Joel Grey immediately took a liking to me and in fact made me his conductor for a while. And I will tell you what happened. Felix Giglio, you remember that name?
I never met the person, but I do remember the name, seeing it actually in playbills.
Right. Felix w was a violinist. He was also David Merrick's contractor at that time. Was in the pit. Harvey Estrin, our friend, was in the pit. Red Press was in the pit. I don't know if you remember Freddie Vogelgesang, who was a violinist who actually did the Brahms horn trio, recorded all three parts by himself,
Wow.
who had been the assistant conductor on West Side Story in a million shows. He had no business being in the pit. He was too good for it. So, and all these guys were in the pit, and they all gave me the seal of approval because I was this young hotshot. And I say this modestly. I don't mean it that way. I had a gift for it, and they recognized it. And because of that, the word got around very quickly. So Felix was on another show, and he said to David Merrick, the conductor's taking a vacation, I got this kid. And I went in on that show. And I started going in on shows without a rehearsal as the takeover conductor, and nothing went wrong. That's the best I can say about it.
Well, that in itself is a huge accomplishment. That would be unheard of today.
Right. That's exactly. And also, I was 22 years old, 6 foot something tall, and dark. And I got along with the leading men, I got along with the leading ladies, and everybody knew me from playing rehearsals. So they were happy to see me down there. And I got to say that that part of the personal relationships is half the battle.
Yes, and you've had a long career of also working with just about every major star, either orchestrating for them, music directing for them, accompanying them. Let's speak to that, because that's something that you don't get taught in schools. That the way you relate to people is as important and sometimes more important than your abilities on your particular instrument, or even as a
Absolutely.
composer or arranger.
Well, absolutely. I think now perhaps I was overconfident, but I also took it very seriously. So if I didn't know something, I studied. And I not only studied books and everything I could find, I would call up the people who were on Broadway, all the conductors, and talk to them and ask them questions. I was doing my research because that's what I decided I wanted to do. So I was, I could pick up the phone and talk to Milt Rosenstock, who was one of the great Broadway conductors. And I went to school with Milton Green's son. So I would get people on the phone and actually quiz them about stuff. And another great conductor on Broadway was a guy named Herb Grossman, who unfortunately never had any hits, but he had been Fritz Reiner's assistant
Jesus.
and was an opera conductor. And you see his name on a lot of translations of operatic literature to English. And I watched these guys conduct, and I would sit in the first row and see how they handled orchestras. I'd get myself invited to orchestra rehearsals by friends in the band. And because I was a personable 22-year-old kid, they say, sure, let them watch.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
that.
again, this would be somewhat impossible to imagine today happening, but that's also speaks to now. How did you the fact that all right, you were getting yourself involved as a conductor, getting known, you had obviously a gift for this, but where, how did you move into orchestration as being becoming perhaps even bigger part of your career than even conducting?
Well, what happened? I was always interested in the orchestration when I was conducting the shows, and I was very fortunate working. I mean, Good Time Charlie was Jonathan Tunick. And then when I finally, and then I did the tour of Little Night Music as the assistant conductor. So I was sitting in the middle of his orchestration, plus a lot of shows I had done in summer stock. I was always interested. And at stock, the orchestra's cut down, so you end up having to do some writing without knowing anything, just to make the orchestra sound, be missing parts. Well, I was doing this show called Copperfield. The orchestrator was Irwin Kostel, who was very well known, even to the public, because he had been the music director on the Gary Moore show for years and was always introduced. He was like Mr. CBS. He was on television all the time. He had done the movie of Mary Poppins. West Side Story was his big claim to fame with Sid Raymond, and the show Fiorello, which was the first Broadway show I saw. So anyway, when I met Irv, I was absolutely, in awe of him. And I think about it, when I met him, he was just a few years younger than I am right now, and I was, as I said, 28 years old. And I've told you the story, but I'll tell you, he saw me conduct and he was very complimentary. And it turned out that I was studying through my conducting teacher, Rudy Bennett, the studies, the conducting of Nicolai Malko. And it turned out Irv was his last student, and he adopted me for the rest of his life, and I was his protege. And Irv, I didn't tell you this part of the story. I was conducting rehearsal of Copperfield. And I was on the podium, and Irv was like 6 foot 2. He comes up, puts his arm around me. He says, "Larry, why don't you move to Hollywood?" He said, "I'll teach you to write, and you can conduct your own shit instead of this shit." That's exactly what he said to me. And when I finally did go to LA with a show called Sugar Babies, I did the tour. After the end of the show, there's a tap on my shoulder, and there are two guys standing there. It was Irv, and he said, "Larry, this is Peter Matz." Shook hands with Pete Matz, and he said, "You were planning to call me, weren't you?" And he took over my life and taught me to write.
Yeah, I mean, Irv Kostel is a legend, not only in the commercial music world, but you know, in I should say the classical world as it existed in mid 20th century America and in the early days of TV, as you mentioned, his affiliation with CBS, and when he would be on CBS, and there are still some YouTube productions that are conducted on CBS, and you can see them in their entirety. Our old friend Joe Soldo sent me some years ago, and incredible orchestras with a band built in. I mean, and they could do anything. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing. And this was, you know, one of the main channels, CBS nationwide broadcast in prime time. And you'd hear these magnificent musicians and orchestrations, and so you really sort of struck gold by being adopted, in a sense, musically adopted by Irv Kostel. And Peter Matz is not a bad second year, a magnificent conductor and orchestrator, and quite frankly, didn't get, I think, enough credit for really helping build Barbra Streisand's career.
Oh, absolutely. And I also should mention Ralph Burns, who I worked with as well, who also was very supportive. Ralph, when I met him, was probably coming up on 60. And he said to me, one of the most important things you can do as you come up is stay in touch with younger people. He said, so that when you're 60 years old, you're still working. He said, otherwise, you're just gonna be one of the old guys sitting in the pit.
Interesting. That's it. That there's a nugget to be really cherished. Always stay in contact with younger people because, as you move through your career, there is the unwritten age discrimination thing that is natural. It's just what happens. And certainly Broadway is more of a young person's medium.
Well, as I
In the
told you, Pete Matt said, conducting on Broadway is for the very young.
Yeah.
And also Ralph at an orchestra rehearsal, Marvin Hamlisch was the composer. We're playing a chart, and Marvin is tearing it apart. Not because it was bad or anything, he just was making it his own. He said, take the saxophone out, take this out, cut that out. And I was on the podium, and Ralph leans over and says, he's fucking with my masterpiece. Never
Well,
forgotten that.
there you go. But that is, but that's what you have to do sometimes. You just have to bite your tongue. I'll give you a great example. We hadn't talked about this before. In the early rehearsals of Victor Victoria, which was Billy Byers' last show of orchestrating Henry Mancini's music, they wanted to add a ballad for Julie Andrews, who was the star of the show, and her husband, Blake Edwards, was the producer. And Billy Byers orchestrated this beautiful ballad. And we came in a half hour early, rehearsed it before one of the shows, and we ran through it once or twice. Ian Frazier was the conductor. And as I'm playing this, I'm thinking, man, if I have to play this every night, this is going to be great. It was so beautiful. The string writing was beyond, I had not experienced anything like that in the Broadway pit before. It was gorgeous. Julie came to the front of the stage. She was smiling. Billy, and from the back of the auditorium, we hear Blake Edwards yell, cut it. And it was deathly silence. Ian Frazier had turned to Billy just before that and said, Billy, you outdid yourself. Billy walks to the front of the orchestra. Let me have the music. He takes the music, leaves the theater. I see him the next day and I said, Billy, I don't understand that. It was one of the most beautiful things I've ever played in commercial music. It was absolutely gorgeous. And I said, what'd you do with it? He said, I threw it out. I said, what do you mean? He said, I threw it in the garbage. I said, I don't understand. Why would you do that? He said, I'm work for hire. And basically, that was one of the great lessons I ever got. You might write your butt off. You might be playing something so great, but you're working for someone. And if they don't like it, even if they're 100% wrong, there's nothing you can do about it. You're work for hire. And that's something I think musicians, composers, arrangers, conduct, we all have to keep in mind that regardless of how we feel artistically, there's
Yeah,
always
it's
so the person who's footing the bill has the ultimate call. And unfortunately, we are just employees.
so much for art.
Exactly.
And I realize this too, that sometimes it's very frustrating, and other times just go like that. I saw it happen with Costell as well. He wrote a beautiful arrangement in Copperfield, and the composer and lyricist, mostly the lyricist, said, "Irv, the arrangement's beautiful, but it's covering my lyric." So Irv didn't argue. The next day it came back and all of his beautiful counterlines gone. Gone. He had rewritten the chart and it was just the usual umchuck. And I asked him, I said, how do you feel about that? And he went,
Yeah,
that's what it is.
that's the lesson. So, Larry, you mentioned, some of the great artists who influenced you early on, especially in writing, as Irv Kostel, Peter Matz, Ralph Burns. You exposed to Jonathan Tunick's wonderful orchestrations in the 70s. What other composers, orchestrators, perhaps in other styles of music, let's say in Western European classical music, have attracted you and influenced you?
Well, just because he was such a great orchestrator, Tchaikovsky was a major influence. And also, believe it or not, Gilbert and Sullivan, because of my interest in theater. And also, I was very interested in the French Impressionist, Ravel, Bolero, and Debussy, all that stuff. Even though I was a pianist, I wasn't so much interested in playing keyboard music. I wasn't that kind of pianist anyway. I was a show pianist. So I was much more interested in orchestral works, and I would listen to everything. I listened to a lot of opera, a lot of Puccini. I liked hearing vocal stuff because I wanted to hear the clarity of the orchestra underneath the lyric, because that's where my interests were. I listened to a lot of pop music, and of course, when we were coming up, Bacharach was a big deal. And of course, you could still turn on the radio and hear the Great American Songbook. So on television, we were hearing Pete Matz all the time, and we were hearing
Right.
Kostel, who, and I was, of course, interested in film music as well. So the music of Jerry Goldsmith was really coming through in those days, and Elmer Bernstein. And of course, later, John Williams. But he was really, I think when John Williams was happening, of course, all the shows we heard on TV as kids when we were probably 10 years old were Johnny Williams themes. But his film music was really in the 70s after Star Wars and stuff like that. But coming up, it was all of it was, I have to say, Tchaikovsky was my biggest influence in terms of orchestration.
And that's interesting. He gets criticized within the classical world as is not as heavy as the structure is not as developed and so forth. But what Tchaikovsky had was an ability for melody that was second to none, maybe second only to Puccini and Verdi, but as you said, beautiful orchestrations. Every year around the holidays we hear the Nutcracker, and every orchestra plays it. The ballet companies play it for a month or so, and the musicians are sick of it. But if you can step back, and it may need to be looked at in the summertime to have enough time in between after playing, 6 weeks of Nutcracker. But the orchestration, the music is absolutely stunning. It is brilliant music, and his symphonies as well, and some of the most beautiful melodies known to mankind, Peter Tchaikovsky gave us. So it doesn't surprise me in a way for someone who's so been so involved in musical theater, where at least in the more majority of the years, musical theater, we did have songs and melodies and great orchestrations to accompany them, and that became, in a sense, part of the American songbook. That's where the American songbook really emanated from, is musical theater. And
What's interesting to me, and just, you just made me think of it, I was the clarity of his orchestration. But the thing was, even though I was a young guy coming up at the time of Bacharach and all that, I preferred the more legit shows. In other words, things like Little Night Music, later Sweeney Todd, and shows that didn't need a drummer were the shows I wanted to conduct, because I thought the rest of it was just easy. I would just count off the orchestra. It was the difference between being a band leader and being
The
a
conductor.
conductor. And I got much more pleasure out of that. And also as an orchestrator, when I think about orchestrating now, the drums are part of the orchestra. It's not the center of the orchestra for me.
Well, that's interesting because every show I did pretty much from the 90s on, maybe the last 25 years of my Broadway experience, the drummer was not only the center, but it had to sit in the center of the pit. And the
Yes.
conductor wanted it right in their face.
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
that, but it sounds like obviously the orchestra, the classical orchestra in a sense, even though in the Broadway pit, a classical orchestra might be 26 or 32 people at the most, but that type of sensibility was what attracted you. And certainly I felt much of that most of my life, with a few exceptions where there was more of a jazz sensibility. And I certainly felt that in City of Angels. And then when I had a chance to do Fosse for a number of years. But yeah, I understand that sensibility. And when you're studying with Irv Kostel and orchestrating, what were the materials that he used to help you enlarge your concept of orchestrating?
It's very funny because what happened was I started getting work as an orchestrator for TV stuff and some film stuff and the theater thing. So Irv would focus on that with me. But of course, in Hollywood, all of a sudden I have these huge orchestras and stuff. I had no experience with that. But what Irv would do is I would have to write my own music for like a TV episode, little cues and stuff like that. And he would say, okay, let's look at this. And he would look at my stuff. So I wasn't necessarily looking at the classics. He wouldn't pull out a score, but he would tell me to listen to stuff. And he would say, this is not going to sound. This is not the way to do it. Write this higher. And he would, I'm trying to think if there was anything really specific. Okay, I had was hired to do some an episode of the TV show Father Dowling's Mysteries. It was a big break for me. They just wanted me to do a couple of cues, and I had to write some silly stuff where the villain comes in and swings a bat and misses and all that kind of stuff. And I wanted to write 12 tone. I knew nothing about 12 tone. So Irv would sit down and he did this whole box of squares and say, let me explain this to you. And he would very slowly say, this is what 12 tone is. Pick this note here, pick this note here. He would give me like the most paint by numbers method of doing it. And then the next day I would write a 12 tone score and he would say, I don't know how you did it, but you did it. He said, I'm not saying it's any good, but you did what you were supposed to do. And that's how he would show me. For example, I would write a chart and the whole band was playing their brains out. He said, you know, it's nice if you make the trumpets and trombones play antiphonally. So the trumpets play, the trombones answer back and forth, because instead of playing all the time. So I would write a chart and they were going like this all the time. And he would look at the chart and after about 2 seconds, he said, do you ever think of having them play together?
So it was sort of like learning in the most practical way
Yes.
possible on the job at the moment, rather than let's go through Schoenberg's approach to harmony, or someone's approach to
Well,
orchestration.
right. And one time I wrote parallel fifths and I said, Irv, I think I wrote a bunch of parallel fifths. He says, when did you get interested in music?
Here's the funny thing about that. When you study theory, and often counterpoint is early on, as it should be in your works. You're writing, and parallel fifths, parallel fourths, no good. And Debussy did that early in his studies at the Paris Conservatory, and he was he was considered a rebel, and was actually dismissed from the Paris Conservatory for writing like this. 20, 25 years later, he became the head of
Right.
the Paris Conservatory.
Well,
There you
I
go.
wrote a chart with a bunch of counterpoint in it, and I showed it to Irv. And I remember this where he said to me, "You don't need me anymore." And I was horrified. It's like my father throwing me out of the house. And I said, "Well, that's very flattering, but what do you mean I don't need you anymore?" He said, "You wrote a three-part counterpoint." He said, "You did it instinctively. If I showed you where you did it, you'd never be able to do it again." And he said, and that's, he said to me, "That's what makes a career." He says, "You do something like that, you have a talent for it, just do it. Don't try to figure it out." And I appreciated that, and I by no means am patting myself on the head because I was just writing some TV cues and stuff like that. But I think that's what happens is you learn things through osmosis by sitting in a pit, sitting next to another player, and you say, "Wow, how did they do that? How did someone sound so great? How did someone, how, you know, sometimes you sit in the pit and you say, "Wow, that's really nice." And we're sitting here playing sugar babies. But there was something that was very well written or very well conceived, or listening to some of Tunick's work, where, another amazing talent, where if you sat in the pit of Little Night Music, you would think it was Debussy at times, the clarity of it.
It's so true. And whether it's as an instrumentalist gaining from another player, or as a composer or orchestrator hearing something that touches you, I mean, it's quite amazing. And you sort of remember those experiences many years later, that you don't forget those, because it hits you right between the eyes, and it's as clear as a bell. And look, I even as a player, I remember, this is an odd thing. It must, I think it was Victor Victoria, which I mentioned previously. The lead trumpet player on that show was John Frosk, one of the greatest lead trumpet players ever. And it was sort of a period type of piece, but there were little inflections that he would bring to it. And John was more to the end of his career at this point, but he still had all of that nuance in his playing. And it's the nuance that I was noticing, saying, man, if this is not just someone who can play the high notes, or who's playing the parts and coming in correctly and playing the phrase, it's nuanced in a certain way. And it's that extra stuff, whether it's from a player or the nuance in a score or the subtlety, that really stays with you. And that when you encounter those, whether it's in a Broadway pit or on the playing in an orchestra or playing chamber music, or playing in a big band, I mean, when that hits, it's so meaningful. And I think that's really what keeps one going in music, trying
Well,
to keep
it's
refining this.
so funny you say that because I noticed that many times, and usually, frankly, in the woodwinds, because that's there's a lot of artists in the woodwind section because of the doubling. I was doing some benefit, and Hank Freeman was. I had the pit band from playing our song for this benefit, and I was, 26, 27 years old, and I was doing a benefit, and we were playing a chart from the show Fiorello, which Costel orchestrated. And this was before I met Costel. And also, Hank Freeman had been the original lead player on that show, or one of the lead players. And I remember him turning to the orchestra and shouting at everybody, "No, come on, guys, it's staccato, play it." And I loved that this one guy in the reed section was telling the whole orchestra how to play it because he knew the. knew the chart. I didn't resent it at all. I was so appreciative of it. And other spots where you have a brass section playing, and I would just look over at Dick Perry, lead trumpet player, one of the greats. And I just look and go like this a little bit, and the whole section would add vibrato and warm it up and put it over the top. Now I wasn't doing the vibrato they were, but Dick would lead the section, and all of a sudden it was music, as opposed to just notes on the page. And when those moments happen, I must add something just silly. I was doing a Pops concert with the Pasadena Pops. A lot of great players in the orchestra. And doing one of these numbers for some rock group. And the music was so repetitious, I had no idea where we were. I couldn't tell what chorus we were on. It was all the same. Everybody was just rolling along, playing these unison figures. I was totally lost. And all I cared about was I knew where the ending was, so cut off together. And I turned to the concertmaster, and under my breath, I said, Amy, where are we? And she looks up at me and said, I was just about to ask you. And this is all.
And you have the earplugs in also because of the volume, of course.
That's right. It was one of those great moments. Fortunately, we discovered the ending together.
Very good. Now, Larry, throughout your career, in all the wearing all these different hats as a conductor, a music director, a composer, orchestrator, can you draw any parallels or discuss the various differences as it affects you? You're being given these hats to wear. And they're all very different, and yet, is there a thread that you find that exists throughout all these various assignments that you've encountered?
Well, yes, originally, as I started as a pianist, I was a pianist in the pit with a few conductors, theater people, but I was promoted very quickly. Just through luck and logistics, I ended up conducting so young. So I was at, stopped being a player, I was on the podium. And the funny thing about conducting is it takes a long time, regardless of your experience as a player, to be able to be on the podium and hear, because you only hear what's in your head rather than what's happening in front of you. And that's when you have conductors yelling at players because they're not, it's not matching what they thought it was supposed to sound like. You have real players, it's live music. They are producing the sound, you are not. And if you learn something by listening to a recording, or in my case, it was music that hadn't been recorded before, I had to sit back and try to keep my hands moving without interfering and hear what was actually happening in real time. That's the first thing, from going from playing to being on the podium. Then to being an orchestrator, where I was a perfectly capable conductor, but someone else is on the podium and I'm listening to something I wrote. To be able to separate myself from the music in that way, to be able to hear it as an orchestrator. And the same thing goes for being a composer. So you have to separate yourself emotionally from it. So it's not, oh my God, what are they doing to my music? And why is it orchestrated this way? And why is he conducting it too slowly? And why did that clarinet player clam? And it happened. I remember when it happened to me. I was conducting a show in 1987 called Teddy and Alice. I had already left New York, was living in LA, doing writing, but not so much. I was conducting, and I came back to conduct another show. And my attitude had changed totally. I realized that we were all in this together. And I was not facing a bunch of adversaries in the pit who were these musicians who weren't up to my standards. I hate to say that's the attitude of many Broadway conductors. It's like, these guys are going to ruin my masterpiece. And the fact was, I became more accommodating and realized we all wanted the same thing. And the proof of the pudding is a Broadway pit orchestra, and you know this. Let's say you're 2 weeks into the run. If a singer on stage cuts two bars, everybody in that pit hears it long before the conductor does. Because they know what they're accustomed to, what they're playing and what they're hearing, even though they may not know the lyrics or what's going on stage, but they know what's supposed to happen. And in a Broadway pit, you cut a few bars and the whole band's there on the next beat. Not just because the conductor's smart and yells out a bar number, because everybody knows where they are anyway.
Right.
I love that. I love that experience. And when I realized that, I got a much better response from the orchestra. And Irv Kostel said to me, "If you live long enough, everybody loves you." And I know what he means, though. It's with experience you become a part of this bigger picture.
Yes. Well, in any discipline, I think the longer you live, the more experience you have, the more able you are to deal with any situation and any changes that occur. Now, on a Broadway show, of course, where you're playing ostensibly the same music every night, 8 shows a week, and if a show is successful, 6 months a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, it can become. It can become boring or trite unless you adopt an attitude of what you said, of actually listening. And I was given a very good piece of advice from Dave Tufani very early on. I don't even think Dave would remember this, but I certainly do. I had taken a lesson from Ray Bekenstein earlier that day. On soprano saxophone, I can remember that. And Ray was playing the show Sugar Babies in town, and Dave was part of the band at that time. And when I came down, Ray introduced me to George Berg, who I think was the in-house contractor of the show at the time, and some other players. And Dave was there, and I had met Dave before. Because he was a big student of Joe Allard's, and as was I, but I was a generation later. I asked Dave this question. I said, I was surprised to see him in the pit because he was so busy in the studios in that time. I said, well, how do you keep your interests going? I mean, I know you're doing all these dates and so forth, but how, you're playing a show at night. I mean, how do you keep your interest? And he says, well, he says, every night, I do my ear training here. He says, I'm listening to other people and I'm trying to imagine what they're playing and writing it down on a piece of paper. He said, I'm trying to use, even though I know my part inside and out, we know what's going on, I'm trying to imagine what they're playing and in my mind, writing it down on a piece of manuscript paper. That was a tremendous lesson that he gave me without, I wasn't even realizing that, and he just let it right out. That's really how he was approaching it, to try to keep himself in the game. And I wasn't as successful to doing that every show. I cannot say that, but I did try to, find different things to latch on to keep myself in the game when you're doing a long-running show. And the same thing as I mentioned before, even if you're playing in a ballet orchestra and you're doing the Nutcracker for the 100th time that particular season, there's infinite ways to maintain your interest and focus, but again, you have to be listening, and that's such a great piece of advice you gave, Larry, about that on all levels, as a player, as a conductor, composer, orchestrator, It seems quite simplistic to just say that, keep your ears open, but to be mentally engaged with your ears open is
Well,
it's not as easy as it sounds.
there was a time where I'd be conducting and I'm thinking about where I'm going to eat between shows. And then I realized it was not constructive. And I, this is something I found out kind of a hard way. I was in France conducting a concert in French, which I'm just learning to speak, but I was there.
Me
It was
too, by the way.
yeah.
I'm using Babbel to help me
Oh,
with.
good. Babbel's good and Duolingo's good, all those things. And I have a French teacher. So w what happened was just before the show started, I get a call from my daughter, and this is when the fires were happening here in LA. And she said they're evacuating the neighborhood where our house is. And she said, "What do you want me to do?" I said, "Get to the house, and there are certain papers I want her to get out." I said, "Are you safe?" She said, "Yeah, but they're evacuating." I said, "Go get this, go get this." And I had to go on stage a moment later. And I was, of course, very shaken up because here I am in the middle of France, you know, with a 9 hour time difference, and my house is potentially going to go up in smoke. It didn't. Everything was fine. But I had to go on stage and conduct the show. As simplistic as the show might be, you know, doing the overture to Cabaret or whatever it was, I was shaken, and I said to myself, "Feet, do your stuff." And I said, "Focus." And what happened was I thought of nothing except what I was doing. And it was one of the best performances I ever did because I was totally within the music. I just said, "I know this is whatever you want to call it, you know, it's simplistic music," but I focused on it. And I realized if I can do that at every performance, which is hard to do, to stay really in the moment and instead of thinking about what's going on there and the light's not right and then this guy's doesn't have his instrument out of the case yet, you know, this kind of stuff. I just say, it's not, as Marvin Hamlisch once said to me, "Who cares? It's in four." You know, it's, I was really looking at it and saying, "I'm going to make this as best as I could." And it was wonderful. And I really try to remind myself of that all the time.
That's a great lesson, and I sort of just want to wrap up a little bit by getting your opinion on what advice do you give or would you give to young people who are looking at having a career either as a conductor or orchestrator in today's world, music world, which is very different than the world we grew up in, obviously, and on all levels. The industry is different, musical theater is different, the record industry is hugely different, the film industry is different. Given that and your experience, and your ability to see things now, and looking back and perhaps looking forward, what advice would you offer them?
Well, it's something that didn't make sense to me when it was said to me, but Irv Kostel said to me, you know, I wasn't even 30 years old. He said, "There's a piece of the pie for everybody." And the difference is right now, it's a much smaller pie. It's not, there's not as much work. There's not, the industry is collapsing into streaming, into electronics, where some people, that's a whole other discussion. What's the difference between the synthesizer playing a harp part and a real harp? You know, we go into that too, and real woodwinds as opposed to the bassoon on the keyboard. And there's a piece of the pie for everybody. And the thing is, he always said to me, "Keep studying and be ready for when the day comes, because the day is going to come where someone asks you to do something, and if you didn't get ready for it, either as a player or as a writer or as a conductor, you got nothing. So I think people have to keep studying, be interested in it, be totally, you have to want it more than anything. You can't, it's difficult to be working at the grocery on, all week and then playing a show on the weekends. You can't do it.
I mean that you have to be totally engaged and somehow find a way to survive those slow times and not give up to at least not give up without giving it your best effort.
Just made me think of something, and I have to tell you this. I was in the pit of in Florida at the Parker Playhouse, and oh no, it was Coconut Grove Playhouse. I was 23, 24. I was conducting a production of No No Nanette. The band was 100 years old. The first clarinet player told me he played Showboat, and I said, "The 1947 revival?" He said, "No, the original." Okay. And my piano player was a guy named Ted Seidenberg, who conducted many, many Broadway shows and had been Heifetz accompanist when he was 20 years old. He had conducted a slew of Broadway shows, including the original Clear Day, and he had retired down to Florida, and he was playing the pit piano on No No Nanette.
Unbelievable.
And he befriended me, and clarinet player had a solo. I point to the clarinet player, bring my hand down, nothing. Second time, nothing. At this point, the singer's waiting for the cue. I'm sweating bricks. Third time, nothing. All of a sudden, Ted plays it on the piano and shouts out, "Don't break your arm, kid."
Been there, done that. That's
You
what he's he had that's
can't
it.
make it up.
Well, that's what you have to expect, you the unexpected. And it never you never get tired of ex realizing that that's what you have to expect is the unexpected. But I think your piece of advice is well demonstrated in your life, but also I think it's a good piece of advice of keep studying, be prepared. There will be a moment when you'll have your shot, or when you'll be asked to do something that maybe if you hadn't continued to study or be inquisitive, be curious about that you'll be called upon, and it's put up or shut up at that moment.
Absolutely.
But Larry, I appreciate it very much, and I know you told me about this book you've written, which is available on Amazon. I think others might be interested. Tell us a little bit about that before we say goodbye.
A few years ago, when COVID was happening and we all had time on our hands, I decided that I wanted to put down everything that I could remember about growing up in New York and basically my career. And I made it a point, by the way, not to say anything bad about anybody. And I mean that in a not to be funny or another way, because I kept on reading these books, and then you know what he did to me, and then this happened, and every show business book was, that prick, what did he do? And I just wanted to show what it was like growing up in New York, being born in the 50s and growing up in the 60s and 70s in that Broadway environment, and going to school in New York City, and what it was actually like being in the business and how my career happened. It's not, and then I wrote, it's so much, this is the progression and the people I met. And I actually mentioned a million names, and my editors said, "Oh, take the names out." And I said, "Those are the people that are going to read this. It's about them." And it wasn't about making money. It's about a progression of show business in that period. So it's called "I Was Playing Their Song." I don't make any money off this book, but buy it because it's interesting, and you might find it interesting. And the little residuals I get, pay my internet costs.
Yeah.
So.
I can appreciate that. So, Larry, thanks so much. It's been such a pleasure catching up
My
on,
pleasure.
and I really enjoyed it. And hang on for a second after we sign off, but
I will.
really appreciate it. And we hope you'll come back for our next interview on JaffeWoodwinds.com. Thank you.